I'm Jane Clayson, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thousands of Chinese troops searched the Tibetan areas of western China today, searching for protesters involved in the recent riots in Tibet's capital. China has posted the photos on the internet of 21 men wanted in connection with the riots in Lhasa. The violence in Lhasa, a stunning show of defiance against more than 50 years of Chinese rule in Tibet, sparked sympathy demonstrations in neighboring provinces. The tensions threatened to overshadow Beijing's attempts to project an image of unity ahead of the Summer Olympics in August. James Miles is Beijing correspondent for The Economist. He was the only Western correspondent in Tibet last week when the riots broke out. He joins us now from Beijing. Welcome.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the situation in Tibet today? What are you hearing?
Well, it's still a very tense situation, and from what we gather, the security forces are being deployed across a very wide area, not only of Tibet itself, but also of ethnic Tibetan regions adjoining Tibet. This is a huge security problem for China and a huge political problem. What they're now facing is insurrection, if you like, in several monasteries over a very wide area. From what we gather, these protests have been continuing since the major outbreak of unrest in Lhasa on March the 14th and 15th. In one particular case in Sichuan province, the authorities have now admitted that they opened fire on demonstrators on Sunday. They said that four people were injured in that shooting, but Tibetans in the area are saying that several people were actually killed by the security forces when they opened fire.
Those riots in Lhasa, what initially sparked them? What did you see?
It began with protests on March the 10th and 11th by monks just outside Lhasa. That coincided with the anniversary of the 1959 uprising on March the 10th. I arrived on the day after that protest, and I had a meeting very early on in my visit with a local government official who acknowledged that unrest had taken place but said the situation in Lhasa was now stable. Well, he couldn't have been proven more wrong, because less than 24 hours later, the city erupted in the biggest anti-Chinese protest that it had seen, I think, not just in the last 20 years. There were major anti-Chinese protests in 1989 as well, but I think these were the biggest we'd seen since that 1959 uprising. It was an extraordinary explosion of anti-Chinese discontent, and also very much focused against an ethnic group in particular, namely the ethnic Han Chinese living in Lhasa itself, and also another ethnic group, the Hui group, who are Muslim people who've been historically an important part of Lhasa, but resented by the Tibetans, just as many Han Chinese are, because they dominate a crucial sector of the of Lhasa's economy. So this was about political issues. It was about religious repression. It was demands for Tibet's freedom. But it was also very much about economic issues, about price rises, about the fact that Hans and Hui's are dominating these key parts of Lhasa's economy. So what we actually saw on March the 14th and 15th was very much ethnically targeted violence. Mm.
Was the Chinese government surprised by all this, do you think? Did they misread the level of anger against China inside Tibet?
I think they did. Of course, they were nervous, and they expected Tibet would be an issue they'd have to deal with, or that would be a problem for them in the build-up to the Olympic Games in Beijing in August. But I don't think they, or indeed many people looking at the situation, really expected the degree of violence that we actually saw on March the 14th and 15th. What astonished me was the slowness with which the security forces responded to this. I think they were taken aback by the rapid escalation of the rioting. So in effect, what happened was that the riots were allowed to play themselves out. Almost every Chinese business there was in that old Tibetan quarter was destroyed during that 24-hour period. with no attempt by the security forces to actually put a stop to that.
You mentioned the Olympics. I wonder where you think this is all headed and what the real impact will be with all the problems in Tibet on the Olympic Games upcoming for China.
Well, I think China will be somewhat reassured that that Western governments remain committed to the Olympics, that there has been no call by any Western power for a boycott of the Olympics. Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown, President Bush, and others will be attending the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. That's really what China mainly wants. And as long as that is secure, I think it'll feel reasonably confident. But you now have an additional element here that is rather unpredictable for China. You've got Tibetan activists outside China, NGOs, many people indeed, sympathizing greatly with the plight of Tibetans. And in spite of the unpleasant ethnic nature of this anti-Chinese unrest in Lhasa, the nature of the crackdown on this unrest has aroused a good deal of sympathy for Tibet around the world. And now with these ongoing protests and this very strong feeling among ordinary Tibetans, that the Olympic Games provide a very rare opportunity for them to bring the rest of the world's attention to their plight, you have a situation that's quite volatile for the Chinese. And if they miscalculate, if they crack down too hard, if we do see bloodshed on a significant scale actually caused by the security forces, then it is possible that Western governments will begin to think differently about the Olympic Games. So China is very, very worried.
James Miles is Beijing correspondent for The Economist. He was in Tibet last week when riots broke out. To read his account of the riots, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
And now to Dharamsala, India, home of the Tibetan government in exile. Today, the Dalai Lama met with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi has been a vocal critic of China, and today she did not mince her words.
If freedom-loving people throughout the world do not speak out against China's oppression in China and Tibet, we have lost all moral authority to speak on behalf of human rights anywhere in the world.
Joining us now is Peter Aronson, a freelance reporter who has been in Dharamsala for the last few months. Peter, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We've just heard from James Miles in Beijing about protests in China and Tibet by Tibetans. But there have also been protests in India by Tibetans living there, mostly peaceful protests so far. What do these protesters want?
Well, if you're just judging by what they're chanting for, they want the killing in Tibet to stop. They want China out of Tibet. They want the United Nations to take action. But I think what they're really looking to do here is to keep the issue alive. They're very media savvy, and they know that China has basically tried to seal the information coming out of Tibet. So in order to keep the issue alive, they're providing images. They're chanting in English, Tibetan, and Hindi. So they're appealing to the Indian audience as well as the international audience. And I've seen messages printed in various European languages as well. So what they want is to keep the issue alive and get the word out.
How has the Indian government responded?
The Indian government is trying to improve its relations with China. So they don't want to do anything that would offend China. And at the same time, they're sensitive to the fact that they invited the Tibetans to live here as refugees. Quietly, they've put some pressure on some Tibetans not to do things that would openly be aggressive toward China. For example, to walk from India to Tibet. And a few days back, Indian authorities arrested 100 Tibetans who were attempting to do just that.
Let's talk about Speaker Pelosi's visit for a moment. The Bush administration has avoided taking a public stance, at least, about China's crackdown on Tibetan protesters. But privately, according to the Washington Post, they are pressing Beijing to show restraint. What is the impact of Speaker Pelosi's visit today? And doesn't it send a strong message to Beijing?
Absolutely. It's clear that Speaker Pelosi used her visit as an opportunity to, as one New York Times reporter put it, stick a finger in China's eye. She called the situation in Tibet a challenge to the conscience of the world. I'm not sure how much more strongly she could have put it. So she's sending a clear message to Beijing and also to the U.S. public.
Peter, how would you say Tibetans received Nancy Pelosi's message?
Well, first of all, they're grateful that she was here. The meeting was planned long back when the Dalai Lama received the Congressional Gold Medal last year. But they're glad to see her here at this time. At the same time, some of them said they would have liked to have seen her go further. They appreciated the fact that she was critical of China, but they would like to see promises of concrete action, and they didn't get that today.
Describe the scene there today, Peter. I've read that thousands of Tibetans were there watching.
That's right. There were about 3,000 Tibetans, including a sea of monks and nuns in maroon robes who were waving Tibetan, U.S., and Indian flags. You saw a lot of Tibetan flags, and people were very, very welcoming and appreciative.
The Dalai Lama also spoke, Peter, and he said that the U.S. president has been very supportive, but it's really up to China and Tibet to solve this problem. He also reiterated something he has said in the past, and I'd like to listen to that now.
If violence becomes out of control, then only my option is resign.
Peter, why would the Dalai Lama threaten to resign if the violence gets out of control? Is he speaking to China there, or is he speaking to the Tibetans?
He's very much speaking to the Tibetans, and this is something he's said for almost two decades now. It's a clear message of nonviolence. He's always advocated nonviolence. Remember, he is a Buddhist monk, and this message is aimed at Tibetans. If you go down the path of violence, you will lose my support. Of course, when he talks about resigning, he's talking about his political role as the head of state in Tibet's government in exile. He can't resign as spiritual leader.
The Dalai Lama has repeatedly stressed that he wants to preserve Tibetan culture and not to seek independence from China, which has controlled Tibet since 1951. So clearly many Tibetans disagree, particularly the younger ones. What do they want?
They want the Chinese out. They want total independence. They want their country back. Now, not all of them. Some of them say that they do support the Dalai Lama's middle way approach, which would be some degree of autonomy, perhaps religious freedom, wherein China would control the foreign policy. This is some of the Tibetans, but they're a vocal element.
Is there thinking among some of the younger Tibetans, the younger culture, that the Dalai Lama has somehow lost touch?
I would say no. He's universally revered. He's the embodiment of Tibet. But clearly, he is a Buddhist monk. So young Tibetans may not take as pure and nonviolent approach as the Dalai Lama does, but even the most extreme Tibetans still respect him and listen to what he has to say. Case in point, there are some Tibetans who are fairly radical who were trying to organize another march from India into Tibet, and the Dalai Lama called them in to speak with them and say, please don't do this. What use is it going and marching into Tibet if you're simply going to get shot in the process? So even those who are most diametrically opposed to the Dalai Lama's political views listen to him with respect.
Peter Aronson, a freelance reporter in Dharamsala, India. Peter, thank you.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, China's crackdown in Tibet and its role in Sudan are leading some congressmen and some activists to call for a boycott of the Olympic Games in Beijing this summer. The Olympics and politics have always mixed, but do boycotts or protests make any difference to the host country? Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. We'll take a look at Olympics past. And later in the broadcast, what a week for the presidential candidates. And why are people at the State Department peeking at all the candidates' passport files? Back after a quick break, here and now. China's response to the unrest in Tibet has led to a familiar call concerning the People's Republic's hosting of the upcoming Summer Olympic Games. That is, boycott. There are calls for a boycott in Congress. The European Union will take up the issue next week. Others are toying with the idea of a boycott, not of the Games themselves, but of the symbolic opening ceremonies on August 8th. Well, ever since the 1936 Summer Games in Berlin, when Adolf Hitler used the platform to showcase his theory of Aryan supremacy, only to be upstaged by African-American Jesse Owens winning four gold medals, politics, protests, and the Olympic Games have been inseparable. Joining us to explain why is Alfred Sen, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Power, Politics, and the Olympic Games. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You say that probably the biggest reason for politics and the Olympic Games being joined so closely is because of the power of television. And now perhaps the internet. The Games are watched by millions of people. There is so much at stake for these governments to make sure that they go off without a hitch. Yet they really are ready-made vehicles for protests, aren't they?
Television offers a stage that people can enter and deliver whatever messages they want if they can get around the security guards. So the television is essentially inviting demonstrations to carry other messages.
One of the most memorable Olympic protests came in 1968. You well remember at the Summer Games in Mexico City, when U.S. track stars Tommy Smith and John Carlos finished first and third, respectively, in the 200-meter race. And then at the medal ceremony to protest racism in the U.S., they lowered their heads and raised their arms in the Black Power salute as the United States national anthem played. You say this moment almost never happened.
The protest at Mexico City is an interesting example of problems of boycott. There had been a movement to encourage American blacks not to participate in the Mexico City Games at all. A number of black athletes, including one particular outstanding basketball player, refused to go. On the other hand, if Carlos and Smith had not been there, their protest would not have been delivered, and this would not be a part of the history of the Games. So that boycott actually means the athletes are not at the Games. There are missed opportunities to make statements about what people are unhappy about. And the people who win the medals don't really worry about the people who didn't come to participate.
4 years after that, of course, in Munich, Germany, protests turned violent and Palestinian terrorists who were demanding the release of 200 prisoners being held by Israel took Israeli athletes hostage. And German police stormed the building where the hostages were being held. And in the end, 11 Israelis died, along with 5 terrorists and 1 policeman. Yet after a brief suspension, the games went on. Was that violence in Munich the biggest threat the games have ever faced, do you think?
In 72 in Munich, there was a question whether the games should have been called off immediately on the spot. A number of commentators writing since then have insisted that they should have been. Lord Kalanin, who was the incoming president of the IOC, insisted in his memoirs it would have been bigger chaos to move everybody out of Munich immediately than it was simply to continue the games.
After the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, President Jimmy Carter organized a big boycott, a multi-nation boycott of the Summer Games to be held in Moscow the following year. And more than 40 nations went along with that protest, but the games went on as scheduled. Then 4 years later, the Soviets organized a boycott of the Summer Games in L.A. by 14 socialist nations. So the question is, have Olympic boycotts or the threat of boycotts ever really accomplished their goals?
The threat of boycotts have had an effect. The first one in preparation for the Berlin Games. This was really very serious. The Americans had a particular problem because there was a split of opinion between the leaders of the AAU and the American Olympic Committee. Avery Brundage, as head of the American Olympic Committee, managed to get the American AAU to approve sending athletes. It can be argued that the Germans toned down their anti-Jewish propaganda for the course of the games, but eventually this had no result. In other cases, there have been boycotts which tend to be simply forgotten. The U.S. boycott in 80 and the Soviet boycott in 84 are the biggest examples. But looking back on it, there were a lot of athletes left very unhappy that they didn't have the chance to participate in this big show.
Given what's happening in Tibet with China, I wonder if hosting the Olympic Games can have a positive impact on the domestic policies of the host government.
Well, I read an article quoting Jacques Rogge, the head of the IOC, as having said several years ago that hosting the Olympic Games would have a positive effect on Chinese policy at home and human rights. This was not the case in Berlin in 1936. Rogge apparently made an effort to compare this to the situation in Seoul, Korea in 1988, where a democratic government came to power as the result of protests before Seoul hosted the games. The two are not at all comparable. China is much, much larger, has a much stronger system, a much stronger administration, much stronger control.
So in the end, despite all the efforts to keep the games free of controversy, is keeping politics out of the Olympics simply a pipe dream?
Well, yes. The Olympic Games are enormous big business. They're enormous show business. People care. Where people care, there are politics. There are people who just want the show and nothing else, and there are people who want to take advantage of the show to correct other problems, social injustices, other issues. Politics and the games are inseparable.
Alfred Sen is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Power, Politics, and the Olympic Games. Professor Sen, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Monday on Here and Now, nervous about holding onto your job in a bad economy? Can the TV show The Office offer any help? That's Monday. Still ahead today, the week in sports. Are you watching the NCAA games online? It's Here and Now. The State Department is acknowledging unauthorized snooping into the passport files of Hillary Clinton, John McCain, and Barack Obama. And Obama receives the endorsement of former presidential rival Bill Richardson. The news capped an up-and-down week in the race for the White House. Hillary Clinton's chances for winning the Democratic Party nomination faded alongside hopes of a revote in Michigan and Florida. Republican John McCain fumbled on foreign policy, and Obama gave an historic speech on race in America, yet still struggled to distance himself from his controversial pastor, Jeremiah Wright. The words of both men are featured in a viral YouTube video that's making the rounds.
I did not hear such incendiary language.
What's going on in white America, U.S. of KKK?
I wasn't in church.
They live below the level of Clarence Colin and condamnesia.
I wasn't in church.
An aide to John McCain has been suspended for sending out a link to that video. Joining us now from Washington is John Harwood, political writer for The New York Times and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Hi, John. Welcome.
Thanks, Jane.
So first, should we call it Passport Gate? Obama's passport files examined three times this year, Hillary Clinton's once last year. Now we hear John McCain's too. Is this simple snooping or are there political motives here?
Well, I think we're going to find out as this investigation goes forward. The State Department is saying that based on what they know so far, it is imprudent curiosity on the part of some contractors, a couple of whom have been fired for this. And I think until we know more, I would assume that I take that on its face and assume that that's really what it is. If it turns out that somebody does have a political agenda, first of all, it'd be hard to know exactly what they were going after if they were going after candidates from both parties, but I'd be surprised, and it would be much more serious then.
Next topic up here. Former Bill Clinton advisor turned critic Dick Morris writes this week that it is over for Hillary Clinton with the news that it doesn't look like Florida and Michigan will have do-over primaries. To your mind, what's the impact of all that?
I don't think it's over for Hillary Clinton. I think that makes her chances less good because what she needs are a couple of things. She needs victories. She needs victories in big states because the core of her argument is that she can win big states and Barack Obama cannot. Mm-hmm. And she also needs pledged delegates because he's got a lead of about 150, 160 in the pledged delegate category. So lacking those, she has a more difficult chance of catching him. But she still does have a last-ditch chance, which is, if she can get on a roll in these remaining primaries in Pennsylvania and some of the states that follow, and if it looks like Barack Obama's really hitting a pothole with his campaign and perhaps faces what Democrats decide are insurmountable electoral problems, then she has an argument to make to the superdelegates. The best thing that's happened to her in that regard is this Jeremiah Wright controversy. It raises doubts among some Democrats of can he really withstand the rigors of a fall campaign. And so she has a bit more to play out here, but certainly it's an uphill fight for her.
So give us a snapshot of the superdelegate vote right now.
Well, there are about 300 remaining uncommitted superdelegates. one fewer this morning now that Bill Richardson is coming out as a supporter of Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But Hillary Clinton needs to get a large proportion of those. She really needs a consensus to form among those uncommitted superdelegates toward the end of the process that she's the strongest candidate, she's the one who can really win in the fall, and that Barack Obama can't. If she can't make that case, she's not going to be the nominee.
With the push and pull of these superdelegates and everything attached to this, how would you say the Democratic Party is handling this stalemate between Obama and Clinton, well or badly?
I think to the average voter, it looks a little chaotic because you have this controversy over whether there are going to be revotes in Michigan and Florida. This is a circumstance that was certainly envisioned when Michigan and Florida both tried to move up, accelerate their position on the calendar. Democrats said that they were taking away the delegates. When that happened, nobody anticipated the race was still going to be going. Everyone assumed, certainly the Hillary Clinton campaign assumed, that on February 5th, when you had 22 states voting, that you were going to then have a decisive contest, that we would have a nominee, and people assumed that Michigan and Florida would be seated after that, and it wouldn't matter. But now, of course, it does matter. Mm-hmm. And to the average voter out there, it looks a little bit like Democrats don't know what they're doing. That's certainly good news for John McCain. And every day that this race goes on between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, that's a good day for John McCain. Mm-hmm.
Much has been said this week, as you know, John, about Barack Obama's speech on race, in which he said he could not disown his pastor Jeremiah Wright, even though he disowned some of his words. And then on a sports radio program, Obama talked about his white grandmother, calling her, quote, a typical white person because of her racial fears. So much circling around this. Was the speech and the aftermath, has that helped him or hurt him, do you think?
I think it's helped him. I think it is the speech that he gave on Tuesday was about as effective as it's possible for a speech like that to be. He's certainly still taking some flack on the right. And taking some flack for the remark that you mentioned, to my way of thinking, that was much ado about nothing. I do think he continues to face the political problem of the association with Wright. He is going to argue, with good reason, Jeremiah Wright's not on the ballot, Barack Obama's on the ballot, but people will continue raising the question of why did you keep going to that church when the pastor was saying things that so many Americans would find offensive. One of the things superdelegates are going to look at is they're going to see how ordinary Americans take their measure of that controversy, which has gotten a lot of exposure on television, on the radio, on the internet. And we're going to have to watch the polls over the next couple of weeks. There are some indications that his poll numbers in a couple of places have gone down relative to both Hillary Clinton and John McCain. So it's a problem that he's still got to deal with, but in terms of what he did as a candidate on Tuesday, it was quite effective.
What about John McCain's overseas trip this week? He misspoke a couple of times, had to be corrected after saying that Iran supported al-Qaeda in Iraq. The trip was meant to really bolster his foreign policy credentials. Any damage done, do you think?
I think the damage is quite slight, and I would put this in a similar category to the average white person remark that Obama made. I don't think many people seriously questioned whether John McCain understands the circumstance in Iraq. If there's one thing that he is, by common agreement, having expertise in, it is the area of national security policy. He certainly did misstate and corrected himself. I think it'll take more evidence to cause people to really question whether he understands what's going on over there. The larger question is, can he capitalize on this time that he has while the Democrats are fighting to build a campaign and connect with voters? And some Republicans think, Jane, that it was a mistake for him to be going overseas, that he should have focused on the economy, which is in so much difficulty domestically, to try to forge a stronger connection in that area where he does not have the same credentials that he does on national security.
John Harwood, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
John Harwood is political writer for The New York Times and chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. And before we go today, the Japanese comic book style manga applied to the Bible? You're listening to Here and Now. March Madness, Major League Baseball in Asia, and how come Barry Bonds still doesn't have a contract? Just some of the topics today for Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, who joins me now. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Jane.
Nice to see you. So rumor has it you guys over there on the other side of the wall of our office wall are watching the NCAA tournament online.
Wait, what gives us away? The occasional cheer?
Exactly. Does the boss know about this? That's what I want to know.
Well, we are, in fact, the only office here at the station where when we press the boss button, I mean, you know, the boss button is supposed to be when you're watching the game, the boss comes by, you press the button, and a spreadsheet immediately appears on your computer monitor. We are, in fact, the only office where when you press the boss button, the game comes up, because that's what we're supposed to be paying attention to.
Right, so this is all business. This is all professional.
Anybody caught looking at a spreadsheet in our office this week is fired.
Can anyone watch those seriously?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's become very easy. You just go to the right website, and we won't advertise anybody here today, and you press the right buttons, and bingo, it's like watching TV.
So CBS recently said it expects to rake in, what, about $23 million in ad revenue over the course of these games. Ad space for the online broadcast, 95% sold out by late last month. Not too bad for college basketball, I guess.
Well, college basketball has been a gigantic business for a good long time, and of course, as a big business, they have one advantage that probably makes other corporations drool, and that is that they don't have to pay their labor. It's a real advantage.
So let's talk about the teams. The word of the week, bracket. Mm-hmm. If you had to choose a winner, who'd it be?
Well, I guess you've asked me that question because in the first 16 games played yesterday, I correctly picked 14.
Thanks for reminding us.
Yes, yeah. It's going very well so far. Now, I don't know. If I wanted to present myself as extremely brilliant, I would say Belmont was my pick to upset the Duke, and I would be one point shy of being a very smart guy. So, that was almost the biggest upset, practically the biggest upset imaginable in this tournament. Belmont fell 1 point shy. Duke lives to play again. Mm.
But really, a team that you're watching that other people might not be looking at?
George Mason a couple of years ago. No, I'm not that long shot guy. I pick with my head rather than my heart. Mm-hmm. If I were a heart guy, I would have picked Cornell because I'll always like the Ivy League entry, and they never get anywhere. But yes, they didn't get anywhere again.
All right. What about the women? UConn still dominant?
UConn is a fantastic team. And one of the things, of course, that makes them so good, they've lost once this season. One of the things that makes them so good is they're so deep. It seems like year after year after year, the consensus best high school player in the country chooses to go to UConn. And Gino Auriemma, the coach there, is blessed year after year. They're not the only team that can win. Tennessee, of course, could win. Maryland could win. Possibly Rutgers, although they have some injuries to contend with. They're a little shallow now on the bench, but there are probably six or seven teams that could win that.
So on to baseball, Bill. Boston Red Sox are in Japan for their season opener against the Oakland A's next week. Why make that trip?
Because the people who run Major League Baseball have decided that everybody in the United States who's likely to buy a warm-up jacket, a replica jersey, or a baseball cap has already done it. And so it's time to sell that stuff to people in Japan and also to people in China and England and South Africa and all the other places where Major League Baseball is trying to spread their product. Mm.
All about money.
Absolutely.
So both teams will be playing exhibition games against Japanese teams next week, I guess March 22nd, 23rd. Something got in the way, though, wasn't it?
Well, something almost got in the way, at least if you believe the propaganda. I don't think there was ever any real danger that the Red Sox wouldn't make the trip, but at the last minute they said they wouldn't make the trip unless Major League Baseball paid their coaches and manager the $40,000 that they had previously promised to pay to those men. There was a compromise. Major League Baseball came up with $20,000 per man, and the Red Sox made up the difference, and so they got on the plane and went to Japan.
I've got to ask you about Barry Bonds before we go quickly. Still waiting for a deal?
Well, he's not going to get a deal. He's middle-aged. He can't play in the outfield anymore, and he may be in jail before the season begins. So these are all good reasons not to offer him a contract, I think.
That's why I like to ask you these questions. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Bill, great as always to have you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, the Bible as a graphic novel. Back after a quick break. This is Here and Now. boom, zap. Those are the words you'd expect sprawled out over the pages of a comic book, and they are exactly what you will find in the manga Bible, a Bible for the 21st century told in the form of a Japanese comic style known as manga. In this version, Cain lures Abel to his death by saying, "What's up, bro? I've got something I want to show you." And Saul the persecutor becomes Paul the apostle with the words, "It's kind of hard to say no to God, especially when he asks you nicely in person." Of course, the Bible has been told in every imaginable form, from stained glass windows in medieval churches to Hollywood epics with the proverbial cast of thousands. This one has a fan in the Archbishop of Canterbury, who says it will convey the shock and freshness of the Bible in a unique way. Ajibayo Akinshiku, creator of the manga Bible, joins us from England. Nice to have you with us.
How you doing?
Tell us about this comic form manga. It's Japanese, and you can almost call it really a different language. Describe it.
It came out of the 1940s. It's just after the war. The devastation of Nagasaki and Hiroshima really shocked the inventor, Tezuka, who was a doctor at that time. And he decided to come up with a medium that countered the militarism of the Japanese mindset. Mm. And this was the birth of modern manga as we know it.
And so why manga here? What does that form of expression bring to the Bible?
I think where the manga is quite strong as a device is telling the stories in a dramatic sense. And I'll give you one example. Where Jesus Christ comes in from the desert. And as he comes in from the desert, he comes in silhouette. He almost looks like a creature from the deep, rising out of the shadows. And it's quite intimidating. People don't tend to see Jesus in that light. But as he comes in to the scene from the desert, there's a madman who's been terrorizing the local population. Jesus straight away casts out the devil from this character. It's quite manga-ish in the way it's told. It's very unusual to see Jesus Christ in that kind of light. In this case, he comes in from the cold, like any typical, you know, samurai or even a character in the Western movie coming in and then saving the town.
So this is the Bible then in, what, about 200 pages, which it means
is.
You had to take out some things and you had to make decisions about what to include and
yes.
and what to leave out, like, for example, the Sermon on the Mount, which is
yes.
missing.
Yeah, it's the greatest sermon ever told. It's better when you hear actually someone actually speak it than read it on the page of a comic book. There are several other things that we could have actually put in, which we didn't put in, and we had to cut things out. That meant that long sermons like Sermon on the Mount, where you just essentially have talking heads and a monologue, for that matter, wouldn't work in a comic book narrative.
So when I hear you say things like the slow pace of the Bible in long sermons, I know you're coming at this as a Christian, but do you worry that what you're saying and that the manga Bible generally could be perceived as sacrilegious?
As you know, with every medium, you have to actually edit your material so it suits that genre. Comic books really work telling a story at a steady pace and having the characters interact. And that's how it works.
So tell us one of the stories as you convey it in the manga Bible, one of the more well-known Bible stories.
Very few people know the story of Jonah as comedy. God, for example, says, "I want you to go to the Assyrians and to preach to them and get them to convert or change their ways." And what does Jonah do? He runs in the opposite direction to Joppa. There's actually comedic value in this, which doesn't readily come across in the text, but in the manga Bible, we actually kind of like show that. How he runs in the opposite direction and then he gets swallowed up, you know, by fish and then spat out. The comedy, as the audience at that time would have seen it, it would have been obvious to them, but not obvious to us.
So you're coming at this as a trained theologian, as I understand it. How did your studies impact your storytelling?
In being able to decipher what the genres are, we tend not to actually be aware of the genres that we're looking at. But it's quite strange, isn't it? When you're watching a news broadcast, you take what's been said very seriously. But when you watch a satire, you don't take it quite as seriously, even though the information is exactly the same. So that training helps you to actually understand what the genres are, and so you can convey it.
Why this project for you? You are Nigerian and British, telling the Bible in a Japanese comic form. What does the Bible mean to you personally?
Well, the Bible for me personally is truth, and it tells me more of who I am than any other book that I'm aware of or any other discipline. And it's quite consistent in the information that it gives. And the information is actually quite classic in that it does not change. It's quite, as it is, useful for all time. And the truth of the Bible speaks of Christ. Christ as Lord and Master of the universe, who has come to save us, coming in the form of a human, and then, you know, and then departing again. Those are the essentials of the Bible, or of biblical truth, and I kind of hold them to be there. Much of everything else is up for debate, which we all tend to argue about what's been said here and there, but those are the essential truths. It tells me about me, and it tells me about God. Kind of in a way, it kind of introduces us and says, Shiku, this is you, and then this is God. Meet God. Mm. How do you do, sir? That sort of thing.
With this form of storytelling, Shiku, are you trying to reach out to young readers? Are you trying to envelop them into this into religion in some form?
People tend to think that the Bible is anachronistic in this day and age. I really don't know why they say that. I tend to think that the people who think it is probably haven't really read it properly. But when you go back to it, it tells you stories about human beings who are just like you and I. From Abraham all the way down to Job, they suffer just like we suffer, and they express their pain just as we suffer pain. And they have ambitions also for their children and for themselves, just as we do. And you see them respond to pressures in exactly the same way as we would. And then they respond to God. And in a way, we're expected to respond to God likewise. Positively or negatively, it doesn't really matter. We respond the same way. And in that way, we're saying the Bible is persistently relevant, because human beings have never changed. God has never changed. Evil has not changed. So to young people, I'm saying, look, you know, this stuff was cool then, it can be cool now. It was relevant then, it can be relevant now. The hope is that they take a look at manga, the manga Bible, they read it, they become, how would I say, surprised, actually, at its relevance and how exciting it is. And probably, you know, go on to the text.
Your family are immigrants to England, and I wonder what they think about you becoming an artist and essentially retelling the Bible to a Western audience.
Well, with all African families of the former generation, being an artist is not exactly what they would have thought of as a first choice. Artists then tended to be dropouts, or people who were not clever enough to make it to becoming either a lawyer, accountant, or a doctor. Having said that, things have really moved on since then, 20, 30 years on. And I think I'm probably correct in saying my family never expected that we would be where we are at now. This is my brother and I. My brother, by the way, co-authored the book. He actually wrote the script for it, and he's also an artist, and has achieved quite a lot. So yes, they're quite proud of what we've done. And I think particularly with the manga Bible, you know, seeing for myself, I'm actually honored to actually be given the chance to attempt to interpret the Bible, you know, in my own way. It's an honorable, probably the most honorable thing I've done.
Ajibayo Akinshiku, yes. Creator of the manga Bible from Genesis to Revelation. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
To see some of his art, go to our website, here-now.org, and click on the links. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Robin Young will be back on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.